No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and join in the conversation at 888-627-6008, or you can go to our chat box at the BBS Radio chat box and put in a question, and we'll try to get it answered for you. We're going to have a great show tonight. We have a very interesting guest. First, let me say hello to Maria Sanchez. Maria, how are you? How are
greetings, Michael. Well, we're still the epicenter, I guess, of the United States, and it doesn't look like it's getting any better. In fact, there was an op-ed piece today that said we may look back at 2020 nostalgically because we once were able to at least get outside sometimes, have some supplies, have some wine, have toilet paper, have goods and services, and that may not be the case moving forward.
Well, that's a horrible thing, isn't
terrible.
It?
Terrible, yeah, So, well, alive and well, though.
Well, that's good, and we're going to try to be a little more upbeat today because we have a upbeat story, and we're lucky to have an amazing filmmaker with us today. Mark Levin is an award-winning independent filmmaker dedicated to telling powerful, real stories in a unique, authentic style. He's really great. He's won 4 Emmys, 4 DuPont Columbia Awards, the Peabody Award, the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance Film Festival, and the Camera d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival. Highlights of his work include the groundbreaking Brick City, the groundbreaking docuseries about my hometown, Newark, New Jersey, and its charismatic mayor, Cory Booker, Gang War, Banging in Little Rock, the Emmy Award Thug Life in D.C., My New Town, My New Hometown, and Chicagoland, an 8-hour docuseries. And we're happy to have him here today to discuss his new amazing film, which will debut on HBO on this Tuesday, July 28th at 9 p.m. It's called Stockton on My Mind. Mr. Levin, thank you so much for being with us, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to let Maria, who is from Hollywood and knows all the right questions to ask, take over in a minute. But the first thing I want to say to you is that I watched, you were kind enough to give us an advanced copy of the movie that you shot, and I watched it last night, and I found it amazing. I really did. It was, I think it's just a great piece of work, and it's just coming out at just a really important time. It focuses on this young mayor, Michael Tubbs. He's one of the stars of the movie. He's the youngest and first African-American mayor of Compton, California. Stockton, California. So tell us a little bit about Michael. Why did you take this project on?
Well, Michael, you know, I have been interested in following the story of change agents. You mentioned Brick City, and that was actually, I think, ended up 10 or 12 hours, 2 seasons of following Cory Booker in Newark and then Chicagoland you mentioned. So I became convinced that local politics was much more illuminating, and you could really see where the rubber meets the road and where new ideas could be piloted and where ideology and gridlock were less an issue than in the lunacy in Washington, you know, because you got to, you know, the roads got to be, you know, paved, and the schools got to be opened, and the water's got to be drinkable. When I met Michael, I actually met Michael when he was 22 years old, and he was a city council member in Stockton. And I remember walking down the street with him, and he, at one point he said, Oprah Winfrey, you know, backed me, and she gave a small donation to my campaign, and she's only backed two other politicians, Cory Booker and Barack Obama. And so at that moment, I kind of made a mental note, you know, this young man, I better, you know, stay in touch with him. I better see where he's headed. And in 2016, on that fateful election night that Donald Trump was elected president, was the same night that Michael Tubbs, at age 26, became the youngest mayor of a major American city. And as you said, the first African American. And so I reconnected with him, and when he was discussing some of the things that he was interested in, when this idea of universal basic income or guaranteed income came up, which is something he first came across reading the works of Martin Luther King, it was something I had come across in a number of the films that we had been doing for HBO on the how the global economy impacts real people's lives. That kind of kicked it off and said, oh, if he's going to have the first basic income experiment, in sort of city-based experiment in America, you know, this is something we should look into. So that's kind of how it started.
Wow. You know, since you brought up universal basic income, this is not a new idea. I studied it when I was in college. I did an examination of a book called Politics of a Guaranteed Income, which was actually proposed originally by a Californian, Richard Nixon, who put forth a program with Daniel Patrick Moynihan called the Family Assistance Program, which what people generally call the negative income tax. It seems that Michael's UBI program is a similar thing. And how's that working? In the movie, you talk about it.
Yeah. Well, it's, I mean, it's working tremendously for many of the folks who were in this lottery and whose names were chosen, and they get $500 a month. You know, they can use it at their discretion. That's the big thing. The preliminary results, as reported in the film, are that, you know, the majority, you know, there was always this fear, oh, people will use it for alcohol or gambling or drugs or vice. And, you know, so far the preliminary statistics show the exact opposite, that the majority of people use it for food, basic necessities, prescription drugs, medicine, child care, transportation. It's going to be at the end of this year, you know, there are academics that are attached to it, so it is going to be analyzed quite thoroughly. And it's already caught fire in that mayor announced 2 weeks ago in an op-ed piece in Time magazine that he is now part of a group called the Mayors for a Guaranteed Income, which includes Mayor Ross Baraka of Newark, includes the mayor of L.A., San Francisco, Sacramento, you know, a number of major mayors. So what's interesting is this, when we started the film, this was still an idea that was pretty out there. This was before Andrew Yang ran for, you know, president on the universal basic income platform. So he popularized the idea in many ways. But this coronavirus has taken it to a whole new place. You now have Republicans and Democrats discussing, a second round of direct payments, which is basically what the guaranteed basic income is. It's direct payments, to citizens. So it's come a long way. You've got this coalition. It's being pushed as a kind of not even an ideological, as kind of the next evolution of a social safety net that requires less bureaucracy. So it's going to be fascinating to see how far it goes.
Yeah. Maria?
Yes. First of all, Mr. Levin, I thoroughly enjoyed the documentary, and thank you so much for bringing it to. And I hear I live in California. I knew of him, but I didn't know all the details. But I wanted to let our listeners know that not only are you the director, but you're one of the three producers and one of the two writers. So you wear a lot of hats doing this. And could you let our listeners know how a documentary has a screenwriter?
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up because my editor, Jimmy, who's co-producer on the film, Jimmy Lester, at one point he said, "Mark, we should take a writer's credit." And I said the same thing to him. I said, "Well, it's a documentary." And he goes, "Well, you know, the WGA is weighed in now, and more people, you know, who really kind of in the editing room construct the structure, right, the storytelling. They're now taking writers' credits." So I said, "Jimmy, if that's something that means a lot to you," it's the first time I've taken that credit on, you know, a documentary of this nature. I was not as I had seen a number of documentaries with that credit and wondered, just like you're wondering. But I think now what people are accepting it as is, In the edit room, you really are writing the story out. We call it beating the story out. But in a writer's room, like on a scripted series, that's what they call it. We're beating the story out, you know, when the writers all get together and work on a series. So that is kind of how that came about.
Well, and I would assume it's kind of like a storyboard where you decide what, when you go backwards and forwards with the story and when you see whom and how and
exactly,
as you said,
exactly. Now that documentaries are having this amazing renaissance and, docuseries, and then they're just more talk sometimes about the documentary form than there is about scripted movies, mm-hmm, and TV series. And so much is created in the editing room. I guess this is like elevating what happens in the editing room. So it's not just pushing buttons and make a cut here or there. You really are trying to figure out the structure. And in this case, I mean, this was challenging in that there are, first of all, quite a number of characters. Yes, the mayor is the lead character, no doubt. But to his credit, he was more than willing that the camera not just follow him around. It follow, I would call it, like a network of change agents. So there are other characters, whether they're mentors, whether they're, you know, working in nonprofits with at-risk youth, whether they're teachers. And then there are some young people in the film who, in a way, mirror almost what the mayor's mother and father dealt with in their lives. The mayor's mother had him, or was pregnant when she was 16, so she was a single mom in high school. And there's a young woman, Joy, now, a generation later, facing a similar situation. And his father was a gang leader and, was in high school, graduated high school, but in and out of trouble. And there's a young man, Isaiah, who also, great guy, who's kind of straightened his life out with a mentor, and yet some of the past problems caught up with him, and he faced a very, very similar situation in the criminal justice system as Michael Tubbs Sr. So weaving that together, the personal and the political and policy with quite a number of characters, that was a challenge, I will be the first to admit. And I think that's why Jimmy suggested, you know, are you, Mark, open to me taking and you taking a writer credit? And I said, fine.
I have to agree with you just based on what you explained, because otherwise you just go from point A to Z and it just unfolds linearly. And except right. for you brought in the future and the past and the present and the politics and the personal. And like how interesting that it continued to follow another generation.
I have to be honest, two things that really impacted the course of the film. First of all, Michael, as a 20-something, elected at 26, I was like, Michael, you know, we have to do your personal life, too. It can't just be all politics. You're a 20-something-year-old young man. And when I'm at City Hall in his office, and you know, it's like being in a college dorm. Everybody working there, you know, is under 30, except Daniel, maybe. And so that was the beginning that opened things up, you know, to a kind of wider storytelling. Now, the connection between the personal and the political in Michael's story is so powerful, and that he was open to exploring it. You know, his mother's in the film, and she's quite a character. His grandmother's, you know, and his aunt, the three women who really raised him. And his father is in the film. Now, that's a first. His father, you know, has not appeared, and no one has spoken to him, you know, no media. And Michael, I'll be honest with you, that he wasn't that excited when I proposed that, and I understand. He's a politician and, you know, certainly concerned that people could use that against him. But he was open to my suggestion, which is let me pursue it on my own, Michael, without you being involved, and see if I can meet with your father and then take it from there. So that was a huge surprise that we were able to, with the help of the, you know, California correction system, you know, get a camera in there and add him to the film. That was big. And the other thing is what you brought up. These young people. Now, I have to admit, when I suggested to the mayor, you know, oh, wouldn't it be great if we could find, you know, some young people coming of age now, some involved in some of the programs that, you know, you're supporting, but who are facing some of the challenges, you know, your father and mother faced a generation ago. I said, it's a long shot, but it's worth looking. And Mike Moringa and Cassius, our producers joined me, and, you know, we were like, you know, maybe we'll find somebody, but it's a long shot. The mayor said, why don't you start at Edison High School? Go talk to Brian Biederman, who's now the superintendent of schools. So we went over to Edison High School on the south side of Stockton, the so-called poor side, and it happened to be homecoming, and we just got sucked into the whole thing. And lost ourselves and started meeting people. And, you know, we met Joy, and we met Isaiah, and we met another young man who was in the film, Junior. So I have to say that was karma, luck, whatever you want to call it. It was never, you know, in the original proposal, you know, part of the original proposal. And then the challenge was how to weave all this stuff together so you don't get lost, so you don't, you know, get what we call, you know, character overdose or overload, you know, so that you can follow it all and you can move ahead and stay involved in the film.
Well, you know, I have to say that that is really what you did a masterful job of that. And that's really what I took away from the film. Was that you have these characters like Joy and Isaiah that show that the more things change, the more they stay the same in some sense. And then you have this kid who's going to college who wants to become the photographer. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his name.
Junior.
But Junior, who shows that this isn't fated to be. This isn't the way it has to be. This may be the way that it still is in a lot of cases, but there's also great change coming. And you see it through this young man who wants to go to college, who at one point in the film has his family around him, hugging him and telling him how wonderful he is, because I assume he's the first person in his family to actually go to college, and how That's proud right. they are of him. And you know, you see that the future is not fated, that it can be changed. So I think that's really, really the magic of the film, and that's really what I got out of it. But let me ask you something. Since you and I had a little preliminary conversation before the show, and you shared with me that you grew up in West Orange, New Jersey, which is a town I'm familiar with, do you think that where you grew up and the circumstances you grew up in, this is what motivates you to search out this sort of story, because you saw it, you know, growing up in Port?
That's an interesting question, Michael. I was born in New York in Manhattan, and, you know, probably gene damaged at a young age onto subways, yes. but then moved to Elizabeth, New Jersey. And I think Elizabeth, which is right outside Newark, right south of Newark, and is a working class industrial town, much like Newark. I think that really did shape part of just who I am. I grew up in a working class community. You know, that's not that different from Stockton or Newark or Akron, where I just finished the I Promise series, you know, on the LeBron James school there. So I'm sure that had a major impact. When I moved to, as a teenager, to Maplewood, South Orange, West Orange was actually one of our rivals. But, you know, I moved to the suburbs, which was a totally different thing than kind of growing up on the stoop in Elizabeth, New Jersey. So I think you're right that there was a deep imprinting somehow. And I have returned to communities like that. I feel very comfortable working in diverse communities like that. I mean, Stockton has been called the most diverse city in the United States by U.S. News and World Report. It's a real mix of people. And the other thing, you know, just going back to kind of what you said in the beginning, you know, there was no way we could have ever anticipated kind of where this film was going to land, both in making it and then in releasing it. I remember, and that's to HBO's credit, you know, in other words, that they make films like that. A lot of other places will not make a film like that. They want to know what the beginning, middle, and end is before you even start the film. And they already know when it's going to be on. Now, last fall, when I was talking to Nancy Abraham at HBO about, okay, when are we going to get this on? We're finishing the shooting. And we looked at the calendar, and she was like, oh, my goodness, Mark, you know, next spring is going to be the Democratic presidential primaries, and that's going to suck all the oxygen out of the room. And then in July is going to be the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. And then August is going to be the two conventions. And then in the fall is going to be the presidential campaign. Who is going to want to see anything about Stockton, California? Thankfully, I was able to convince them that, you know, we have to get it on before the election. And what's so amazing is, obviously, the world's been turned upside down, you know, by the coronavirus, the economic collapse, and the social justice movement. All this happening. And 2 weeks ago, I got a call from Nancy, and who said that the HBO execs and AT&T had decided that a week after the premiere on Tuesday, they're going to offer it for free to the public at large, to the general public, starting August 7th for a month as part of kind of their corporate social responsibility, and because it speaks to this moment where so many people are demanding fundamental change, an end to systematic racism and economic inequality. And here is a film that shows the seeds of that kind of change. And it's not just in Stockton. You know, this is happening in local communities and in many different places. But we are so lost in the lunacy emanating from our nation's capital, where you are, Michael, that we lose sight that there are a lot of experiments, there are a lot of leaders that are out there and are searching for a new, you know, social compact, a new social contract, a new way of organizing our society that is more just and more equitable. And that is what attracted me to Stockton. I never anticipated that it would come out at a moment where people are hungering for and demanding. And that's why I've embraced the kind of slogan that Michael uses at the beginning of the film, which is upset the setup. That's what people are saying. We're not going back to the way it was. You know, we have to come out of this with a new paradigm, this trauma that we're going through, this incredible crisis. And I think you can already see, this could well be a struggle for the next 10, 20 years, but you can see on one side the scary prospect of a kind of techno-authoritarianism. I mean, look what's happening in Portland. You know, look what happened in Washington, D.C., you know, when Trump came out with his Bible. And then a more liberal or progressive vision that I think people like Michael are planting the seeds of. So there was no way that I could have ever anticipated that this film would land at a moment where people are hungering to see, you know, what is coming next. But it is just fate that it worked out that way.
Divine providence, right? I have to ask you, Mark, and you mentioned it briefly, and I'm a PhD doctoral candidate, and so we're all about evidence-based research. And that was something that Michael talked about, and you mentioned about academics are attached to this $500 a month stipend that I believe went from 12 months to 18 months now. And then you can study, as you said, how it's being spent and where and why and how, so that it really can become a pilot program for the rest of our country.
That is correct. You know, that was part of the idea of this seed project. I think it's going to be, and as Michael says, you know, the idea that people will refer to Stockton not as ground zero for the subprime mortgage meltdown or the largest city at that time to go bankrupt, but as a city that experimented with a new way, although, as Michael said, you're Michael, Richard Nixon was even talking about this, you know, back in the 60s. But I think the fact that they have academics attached to it to analyze it, you know, and really with some scientific rigor, is going to help and make it less of an ideological battle and hopefully more of an evidence base, like how do we get things done? And so that is certainly the hope, and so far, in fact, I think you can go online to the seed program in Stockton and actually look. I think that, you know, they've got preliminary findings, they've got oral interviews, you know, so you get a better sense of how something like this could work.
Because we were talking, Michael and I had a guest that was talking about reparations, and they were saying that the money would be earmarked, but it would be have constraints, that it had to be spent either through psychosocial services or, do you remember this, Michael, or education, or they weren't going to give free rein. And so that's how the Stockton experiment differs from other experiments, which is interesting that if you give people the power and you embolden them about their own personal lives, they make better decisions for themselves.
That is a huge component of it. And the other component is it's not just based on need. In other words, and there are many variations, and certainly one being discussed on a national level is where there's a cutoff. In other words, people that are doing fairly well don't need to be, you know, supported by necessarily a guaranteed or basic income. But in this case, they picked neighborhoods that were the mean average, you know, earner. In other words, was, I think, close to $50,000 a year. But you could live in a neighborhood like that and make $125,000, or you could live in a neighborhood like that and, you know, be closer to poverty level and still get chosen in the lottery, and you wouldn't be disqualified. So that is a whole thing, is a question of means, and is it, you know, a universal basic income? The idea is for everybody. It would be across the board. Everybody would get, you know, some kind of basic income. The guaranteed income is more targeted. This was kind of like it's only a small group of people, 125, but it wasn't means tested, and as you've said, it allows the individual to make those choices, and that is a huge component. And I think one of the things they're going to study is not just how people spent the money, but it's how it impacted their physical and mental health. And that might be a very, very major component of this.
Well, you know, Maria, and just to add to that, that was very much the argument against the family assistance program, that it wasn't, you know, that it didn't direct the money into a particular use the way food stamps and other welfare programs at the time, which the guaranteed income would have replaced, did. And so that's an attitude that I think has changed over time, for the better, of course. And let me say that I know this was your vision, Mark, but this, another thing I got out of the film that surprised me were the kind of people that support Michael Tubbs. You know, I guess it wouldn't have surprised me to see a lot of young people that supported him, but you also showed a lot of, you know, it was certainly multicultural and people of all ages that really support him, even though there were people that criticized him as well. You can't be in politics without having critics, but it surprised me that there was there was a wider range of people that supported this young man than I expected to see.
I would say, and I think it's instructive to where we're at right now as a country, that think about it. Stockton went about as far down as you can go for a city. Not only was it like ground zero for the subprime mortgage meltdown, which kicked off the Great Recession of 2008, then it went bankrupt. So I think there was a sense that it's like the establishment in Stockton, the players who had kind of run the city, it was like, we can't get any worse. I mean, Forbes magazine called it the most miserable city in the United States. So they were ready to turn where other communities might not have, you know, to a 26-year-old African-American who was born on the south side of Stockton. I think they were open. Obviously, there were young people who supported him, but like you're saying, I think across the board, there was a population was like, we can't get any worse. Why not try something new? And, you know, he had been a city council person, so he already had made a name for himself in the community. And like you said, at the same time, I don't want to be naive. There are haters wherever you go. Yeah. And I tell you, that's one of the things that I respect about politicians is just the abuse they take. It's unbelievable. And no matter, you know, I think that Michael is genuine and that he is well-intentioned and it is not me, me, me. It is we. How do we help others? How, as he said, he upset the setup, and instead of ending up as his father did in jail or as his cousin tragically did dead, you know, he made it to Stanford. He became an intern in the White House. You know, he became a city council person and then mayor. So how do you upset the setup? How do you make it possible for many, many others to do that? I think that is genuine. It's motivated by his own personal life. But it doesn't mean there aren't myriad obstacles, and it doesn't mean that there aren't people coming at you all the time, you know, calling you whatever names they can think of.
Well, you know, I must say that I've always considered it as a politician a benefit coming from an Italian family in Newark, because I don't think, even though people in the press have said terrible things about me, they've never said anything worse than my own family has said to me.
So you get to
build up a shield. But let me say that, yes, that's something that really impressed me. This week, in a quote from Alexandria Ocasio Cortez, who you know is this young member of Congress from Brooklyn, she said, I'm sorry, from the Bronx, she said, "We're not here to rule, we're here to serve." And I really got that impression from Michael, that he really feels that.
Yeah, and look, I think it's an antidote we need. I mean, look, these are dark times. These are troubled times, although, you know, there is this uprising demanding we upset the setup, that things change, that we come up with a new social contract. But you can get depressed watching the news every night and then seeing the freak show down in Washington. It's just madness. And we need to be reminded that there are people in leadership positions who genuinely want to try to make a difference for the public good, for the common good. And, you know, we need to be reminded of that. It's so easy to become so cynical. And it's also so easy to say, oh, they're all the same. Who cares about voting? Who cares about even being an informed citizen? You know, what do I need to know any of this stuff for? They're all corrupt, and I'm not even going to participate. And unfortunately, you know, majority of Americans of voting age don't participate. So I'm hoping that the film touches people. It makes them think. But it also makes them want to be involved in their community, to want to be an informed citizen, to want to get in the middle of all this. Yes, it takes energy, it takes time, but that's the way you make a difference. And it can be done, and it has been done through history. As he says to young people in the film, he says, think of what your ancestors went through. Think of what your grandparents and your great-grandparents, or even your parents like Junior, who came from Mexico, who worked two jobs in the fields, you know, so that their son could be the first to go to college. You know, so in the, you know, as Rahm Emanuel said, never let a crisis go to waste. Well, we're living through an epic crisis here, and we can't let it go to waste. We have to use this. As out of the Great Depression came all the New Deal ideas, and that set the stage for, you know, the most equitable and incredible growth of the middle class and in the United States. And we kind of moved away from that in the late 70s and into the 80s. And yes, government can be bureaucratic and it can be a problem, but, you know, it's not, as in Reagan's words, the problem. And it's not that the marketplace, which is, you know, got incredible energy and comes up with tremendous new ideas and innovations. But no, the market is not the solution. That's what we're living through now. The market is not the solution to, you know, to the corona crisis. It's not the solution to opening our public schools, you know, this fall. You need to have government to provide protection, security, and aid for the citizens. And you need to have competent government. So I'm hoping that, you know, for a younger generation that certainly has taken to the streets, you know, we know it has to go beyond that. And we know, you know, in this film they use the phrase boomerang, which I have to admit I hadn't heard. In other words, for young people who make it, you know, to Stanford, who make it into Harvard, who make it into good schools all over and get great offers, but that they become boomerangs. They come home and they bring that talent home to try to lift their own hometown up.
Well, I must say that the one phrase that really stuck with me that he uses is that you're your grandparents' wildest dream. I think, you know, when you go to college and when you succeed, and I think that was very poignant. Go ahead, Maria, I'm sorry.
It's okay. I just wanted to say as a backdrop, because not everybody who's listening might understand the perspective of that which Stockton is, other than it's in California, that they have over 300,000 folks that live there. 45% are white, 12% are black, 21% are Asian, and 42% are Hispanic. So it is as diverse as you suggested it was, and the income goes all over the charts. But home ownership, incidentally, is about 50%, which I thought was interesting, especially since you mentioned, Mark, about subprime debacle. So they've obviously done something to rebound from that, which is great.
Yes. No, no.
But this is a point.
One of the more fiscally actually secure cities in California right now. And, I mean, what happened, you know, the thing is that because it's between Sacramento and the Bay Area, you know, people who can't afford the Bay Area and Silicon Valley, you know, saw it as, oh, here's a place we can get a cheap home, a nice home, and we just have to commute an hour and a half. So that's kind of how the whole craze started. And now, you know, it's much more settled. It is on the tip of the San Joaquin Valley, you know, which is the largest agricultural producer, you know, in the United States. So they're more stable, but that, you know, look, they still face all the problems that so many big cities do, you know, in public education, in, you know, violent crime, in homelessness. You know, these are problems that are in Newark, that are in Washington. I mean, you know, I did a bunch of films in Washington, Michael. I did Thug Life in D.C. in the D.C. jails back in 97. I did the feature film Slam in the D.C. jail, which won Sundance and the Camera D'Or in Cannes. So, you know, the criminal justice reform is a huge issue for Michael, obviously. You know, his father's in prison, but there's a young woman in the film, Jasmine. She has been promoted from when she was in the film. She's now running Governor Newsom's effort to reform juvenile justice in California. And, you know, depending on the pandemic, but there's a plan now that the governor is pushing, and Jasmine as kind of the tip of the spear, to basically close the juvenile prisons in California, which have become like crime schools, and replace them with some other alternative kind of therapeutic community approach. So, you know, some of these ideas that are percolating in Stockton are now spreading in other ways.
Oh, that's a big statement. I don't know how she kept her mental health, because she was teary so much because of the sadness of what it is that she, her casework.
I know. And she's only like 24 years old.
She looks so young. I was like, it's
unbelievable.
She
was an intern
sanity
for Michael. That's how she started.
Oh,
and as I say, now she's one of the key people in the governor's, you know, task force looking at the future of juvenile justice.
Well, you know, and that makes your point very clearly, Mark, that these people bring home so much when they come back to the community. I wasn't very clear on this in the film, but did Michael go to Stanford? Is that what he meant?
Michael went to Stanford. He got a full scholarship to Stanford. And even that, you know, it's not in the film, but he related to me how, you know, when he was in high school, you know, he did very well, but, you know, he acted out. He had his issues. He does discuss that in the film. But he had some mentors, and they made a huge difference. It was one of his teachers who was a mentor to him who convinced him to apply to Stanford, because he said, Stanford, there's no way I can afford Stanford. There's no way I'm going to get into Stanford. And she kept on his case. In fact, she was the one that helped him kind of focus on writing this essay, which you do hear the first few lines in the film, which started with a line that I still remember, which is, the first time I saw my father, he was in chains. I mean, that is just such a heavy line. And that was the beginning of Michael's college admission essay. And it obviously had an impact. So, yeah, he went to Stanford on a full scholarship, and that changed his whole life. In fact, as he relates in the film, you know, across the hallway was Evan Spiegel, who went on to found Snapchat, and who, you know, 3 years ago donated $20 million to start the Stockton Scholars Program, which is this program that you see in the documentary, you know, that if you graduate high school in the Unified Stockton Public Schools, you can get this scholarship money to go to a state university or junior college.
So yeah, Stockton, that's amazing.
You know, I mean, Stanford was a huge, huge turning point in Michael's life.
Well, you know, and I think it's so important. I think this is why films like this are so important, because they bring this idea to America, and you can, you know, you can see, we all need to see this. I always think of this doctor that I once heard quoted, who went to University of Pennsylvania Medical School, graduated at the top of his class, and said that he hated, above all people, he hated his advisor in medical school, because his advisor sent him to an emergency room in Harlem. He was black. And he sent him to an emergency room in black in Harlem, where he spent 30 years of his career. Because he said before he knew that that place existed, he was fine moving into a wealthy practice outside of Philadelphia. But once he saw it, he couldn't turn his back on it anymore. So I think it's so important to show these things, because once we see them, it is much harder to ignore them. And I think that's part of our problem. And we're seeing that now with the Black Lives Matter movement, isn't it? That we've ignored. It's not that we've come out against these people, but, you know, come out against young people or African-Americans or poor people. We've just ignored them for a very, very long time. And it's time to stop ignoring them. So what's the next project for you, Michael? Because Mark, because we're starting to run out of time here.
Okay, well, two things percolating immediately. One is a film that I'm doing with Sonia Sohn, who actually was one of the stars of Slam, the movie I made, and then went on to be a star of The Wire, which was on HBO. Mm-hmm. And this is her second documentary she'll be directing. I'm producing with Daphne Pinkerson on police corruption, of all things, in Baltimore, where, as you probably know, they had one of the worst police corruption scandals, the Gun Trace Task Force, their elite anti-gun and anti-gang unit that went bad and basically turned into a criminal gang. And there's also, you know, the death of a police officer in the middle of it. So that's coming after this on HBO. And then I'm also starting the second season of I Promise. I Promise was a series on Quibi. It's actually, we'll find out on Tuesday if it makes it to the Emmy nominations for a short-form documentary series. But we were one of the first with Quibi when they launched in April. And this was a series on the public school that LeBron James and his foundation helped start in Akron, his hometown, for at-risk youth, starting with third and fourth graders. And we chronicled the first year of that. That was what the Quibi series is. And now we are starting filming, you know, the whole reopening process, which, you know, Ohio, like many other states, is struggling with because there's been a resurgence of the virus. So I Promise, the reopening is also in the works right now.
Oh, that's great. And let me put in a pitch, since I have you on my radio show. You know, DC Statehood is a great, would make a great documentary. I'm one of two elected non-voting senators on the face of the planet. And, you know, of course, we would love to have the focus of a great filmmaker like you on our problem.
I have to say, I mean, I was not aware when I, you know, before we got on, I obviously did a little homework. I was like, Senator, what is this?
Yeah.
So I looked you up. I looked you both up. I was intrigued. And your opening, you know, jingle, I love it. I'll tell you, though, I did this film, Thug Life in D.C., this just for you to know, which was on the D.C. jail back in 97, and two of the young people that were part of that and Slam are now leaders of the criminal justice reform movement and were released because your city, Washington, passed a law that if you got a life sentence and you were under 18, you would be eligible to be released after 20 years. They changed that law. And Haleem Flowers and Mamoulou Stewart, those are two names that you should know. Mamoulou was in Slam and Haleem was in Thug Life in D.C. They're now both in Washington and they have become leaders in this whole criminal justice reform movement. Kim Kardashian, you know, had them in her film, and they're you know, it's just amazing what they're doing. And I have been talking to them before the coronavirus struck about returning to Washington and trying to think up a project down there with them. So, you know, we'll see how it all works out.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, yeah, and I'm welcome to take, I'm willing to take you to lunch anytime you come to town, Mark. We would love to talk to you. But let me ask you, that my own personal interests aside, what haven't we said tonight, Mark? What haven't we asked you that you want to say? Is there anything?
No, you've covered a lot of ground, which I appreciate. I appreciate what your show sets out to do, which is, again, this idea of informed citizenry. Yeah. People have to, you know, kind of educate themselves. We don't teach civics anymore in school.
No.
You know, the participation in the democratic process, it's more a spectator sport. You know, we approach things as consumers instead of citizens. So I applaud what you're both doing. You know, that's the much more constructive role of media. I just hope, you know, folks get an opportunity to see this. And that they get involved. I mean, this is it. You know, we are at a hinge point in history, you know, moving toward the fall and the reopening or whatever happens with schools. And then, of course, the election in November. This is it. This is a huge, huge moment in our personal histories and in our country's history. And the key is to get everybody actively involved and aware of what's at stake and aware that there are ways to move in a positive direction and that they don't have to be just ideological battles of left or right or Republican and Democrat. It really, that's what always attracted me, you know, to the kind of grassroots looking at politics and policy on a grassroots in a city, a mayor, a city council, a board of education, because you can make a difference in people's lives. You can provide opportunities that people would never have, and you can be an antidote to the constant barrage of cynicism and bad news and tragedy that unfortunately, you know, dominates, you know, kind of lead. If it bleeds, it leads. All that is saying, I thank you for the opportunity for a kind of more expansive discussion, a more informed, you know, discussion. And, I just hope you encourage folks to check out Stockton On My Mind and echo that mantra, upset the setup. The time is now to upset the setup.
Well, we should mention, too, again, that it's on HBO on Tuesday. It's debuting. But then, Mark, you mentioned that HBO and AT&T are going to launch it for everybody 1 week later for a month.
That's correct. August 7th, it'll go up on HBO.com, and anybody, you know, in the general public, you don't have to be a subscriber, will be able to watch it.
Which is great.
And
we encourage everybody to watch it. It really is an uplifting film. It shows you that, you know, we are not doomed to repeat the past, that there's a lot of hope out there, and that young people like Michael Tubbs should give us all great hope about the future of America. So thank you so much for being on the show, Mark. We hope you come back sometime, maybe to discuss D.C. statehood, the retrospective. But anyway, thank you so much for being on the
show.
And
continued success, Mark. How great to follow your passion.
I appreciate it, both of you, and the same to you guys. Continue your work. More important than ever now. All righty?
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Mark.
All right. Take care. Have a great evening.
Congratulations. And see you.
You know, we always do a song at the end of the show, and I try to find...
But we always do it after we thank our listeners for making us a part of their week. Because not everybody listens on demand, listens live, but then they download on demand and can listen, you know, on their way to work or on their walk or whatever. And it's an honor and a privilege that you consider us as part, because there's so much out there. We are just grateful for your ears.
And my gracious co-host never forgets to point that out. And thank you so much for listening. Absolutely. And I was going to say that I look for many songs that might be reflective of Stockton, California, but I couldn't find one. So I resorted to an old a standard, which really is appropriate today as it was 45 years ago when it was a top hit. And that's Bob Dylan, The Times They Are Changing.
Perfect.
So we'll see you next week.
Yes, have a great week, everyone. Stay safe.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched. Give the people their right to vote.